afternoon, everybody. I'm Peg Martin, and I'm an alcoholic. And through the grace of God and fellowship of people like you and sponsorship, I've been sober since February the 4th, 1964. I'm very grateful for that. I want to thank the committee for inviting me to come over and speak with you, Glenda in particular. She called me a couple of years ago, I think, to come. And I always enjoy coming over here because I know so many of you. So it's sort of a, it's like I can visit with you and do a little talking, and then, you know, it gives me the excuse of being here with you for a few days, and I like that. I want to thank Kim for attempting to pen on my corsage. I would like to thank Monica for attempting to pen on my corsage. And I would like to thank me for finally pinning it on. I thank you for the corsage, whoever made the corsage. I do love flowers and I like that. But I have no boobs. And so the corsages that I have, usually big busted women should wear corsages because it raises the corsage out of the harm's way. It kind of goes up like this so that when you're hugging people, the corsage stays up here and it gets unharmed. But with me, it hangs down here, so it's always mashed by the end anyway. So I wouldn't worry, whoever gave it to me. It's going to be mashed at the end anyhow. So, but thank you. Thank you. And thank you for my little basket, my goodie basket. I think it was personalized. I'm not sure. But it had certain things in it that Dick and I both enjoy, and I appreciate the thought. First of all, I'd like to say that I am very privileged to be in the company of the people who are speaking here this weekend. They are among my favorites, and certainly some of them, as Mr. Emmerflund and Johnny and Benoit, are people that I have known for years and years and years and who have gone before me. Not Benoit, but the other two have gone before me in terms of beating down the path of sobriety. And they, as Johnny alluded to last night, these people are my heroes. And there is nothing wrong with having heroes in Alcoholics Anonymous. There is nothing wrong with that. As long as I remember that I may be someone's hero, and as such, I need to behave in Alcoholics Anonymous as I behave on a daily basis with responsibility and enthusiasm and commitment to the fellowship of Alcoholics Anonymous. And these two men have done that. These two men over here have done that. And what I want to say is, one of these days, they will not be with us anymore. They'll be in the big meeting in the sky. I ain't wishing it on them. I'm not. But there are people out here in the audience who need to come up and take that role in Alcoholics Anonymous. They need to step forward and take up the mantle of enthusiasm. You know, there's tons and tons of people in AA, and how many of them are enthusiastic? You know, just a handful in your group, I'll bet you. And the most of them are like, what can you do for me? You know, enough about you, let's talk about me. You know, I think that's normal in Alcoholics Anonymous, it's normal. But there's a few of us in the audience and up here at this podium, since I know the backgrounds of many of these people, who need to step up and take on that commitment, take on that enthusiasm of passing on the message, and give them the fire. You know, when I got sober, somebody, and I'll tell you who, lit a fire in me. I mean, they lit a fire in me. It was just a little tiny fire at first. But it got to be a big fire eventually. And sometimes that fire it has to be fed. It has to be fed. I have to be in the solution. I have to be at the meetings. I have to do the things. And that way it fans that fire. You fan that fire. And I have the responsibility of passing that fire that I feel on to other people. Now, not everybody is consumed with fire. I mean, there's just a bunch of us who are just kind of nuts, you know, and we really have to be here because we're bad, bad alcoholics. We're bad to the bone, you know. We're bad, bad alcoholics to the bone. We got egos the size of Texas plus Alaska. You know, we have to always be, we got to be there because that's where we get smushed. You know, when you have an ego that big, you got to be where they smush your ego. You can't be out there where they're telling you how wonderful you are or anything, because there's lots of people who tell you that. You got to be in your home group where they don't care. They don't care. You better be at the door greeting. You better sponsor people. You better do what you say, or they're right there on your butt. And they're saying, you said so-and-so, and you didn't do it. Oh, boy. You know, and that's the way I stay honest. I don't stay honest because I am honest. I am not honest. I think it's fun not to be honest. I mean, or at least in your head. I have to just act honest. It's like, I'm not kind. I just act. What are you shaking your head at? I just act kind. Well, most of the time, I act kind. I act a lot kinder than I wanna act. Because you give me that fire, and I need that fire. And I want it, when these men are gone, or people like me, I mean, I could be hit by a bus tomorrow. With my luck, I'd be sucked out the window of a jet airplane or something in some freak accident, you know, or whatever. I could be gone tomorrow. And if so, who's going to take my place? Somebody's got to step up and take my place. Somebody's got to stay committed. You can't just get committed overnight. Well, yes, you can get committed overnight. But not what I'm talking about. You can't. You got to pay your dues. You got to go to your meetings. You got to do service. And that's where you see God, isn't it? Isn't that what the enthusiasm is? Isn't that what the fire is? The fire in me and the fire in you is the recognition, at least in my thought, is the recognition of our gratitude for being sober and for being given, not only sober, but being given and accepting this way of life. I heard Clancy say this. What's the difference between people who come and who are offered this program, who are just as bad alcoholics as we are, who die? And Jack was talking about someone this morning, you know, who die out there because of this disease. What happens? What's the difference? I don't know. I'm not smart enough. I'm not emotionally capable enough to figure that out. But I do know that in my case, it has been, I think, because, number one, in the beginning, I was too scared. I was scared not to do the things that I needed to do. I was too scared not to go to the meeting. I was too scared of my sponsor not to. I was too scared. But eventually it has developed into that I see at this time, and I see and recognize that this is the greatest gift. This gift that I got in the very beginning, I have met things like this before. Honey, can't you do something about this? It's like ungluing from itself. Okay. Where was I? Caught me all sidetracked. But what I'm saying is that in certain areas, I know in our area, and I know in some of the areas in Iowa, they're having trouble getting people to volunteer for the simplest of committees. Coffee committees, setup committees, institution committees. They have a tough time getting people to do that. And I believe that it's because maybe we forgot where we come from. Maybe we've suffered from problems of success. You know, these are high-class problems.
We have high class problems. When I got here, I was grateful for breathing in and out. I was grateful for a meal. I was grateful to be able to take a fork in my hand and lift a piece of food to my mouth and swallow it without shaking it all over the room. I was grateful that I could take an ice cube tray with a full water load and stick it back in the freezer without slopping it all over the room. I was grateful that I could look somebody in the eye. I was grateful that I had at least one person, my sponsor, who knew where I was at all times and who was worried about me if I didn't show up. I was grateful for those things. And as I have become more successful in life through just being sober, sometimes I forget to be grateful for breathing in and out. And sometimes I forget to be grateful that my hand doesn't shake anymore, and that I can hold a job, and that I have a dog who loves me, that I have a dog. You know, that I have a husband who is a wonderful AA member and who loves me. You know, that my mom and dad, who, you know, wrote me off many, many years ago, made me the executor of their estate. You know, I forget those things because I have problems with success. And that's why I got to keep going to meetings. That's why I have to be in meetings, so I can be small enough to be in the room. That I can be small enough to be grateful for a single bite of food or for an invitation to go eat at somebody's house. You know, those kinds of things are just, I take them for granted today. And it isn't, and the reason I stay in Alcoholics Anonymous is because I need to be here. But I also want the fire to stay on. Because when I don't have the fire, when I don't have the gratitude for God in my heart, when I don't have those things going in my life, be grateful for this too. When I don't have those things going in my life grays out. It grays out because, here he comes, because that's the nature of the alcoholic with an ego as big as Texas and Mount Alaska, is that you can't stay in that ego up there, and so what happens is you get down here. Nothing's any good. Nothing is anything but gray. No color in life. You know, my mother is a long-term chronic depressive. She suffers from honest-to-God clinical depression. And on days, it's cyclical, and on the days that she wakes up in the morning and she's suffering from a bad day, she has told me this, that there is no color in life, that everything is black and white and gray. Thank you.
Just talk.
I can't talk. I can't move my hands. If I can't move my hands, I can't talk.
Here's the Italian again.
Yeah, the Italian. Thank you, honey. My savior. So, yeah. So I really encourage those of you who are leaders in your groups, who are leaders and sponsors of people, to pick up the flag and carry it on. Because someday we won't be here. And I want AA to be. And I want all of those children that are born to my grandchildren who need Alcoholics Anonymous to know what I have known in the years that I've been sober, to know these two guys and other people like them, Denoy, all of those people, Tom, who is, I think, upstairs in the TV room, to know those people and to hear their message and to understand what a God-given gift this is. So, oh, please do
because this has saved my life, and I really want it to pass on to the generations yet to come, as it is today. You know, that it's a wonderful deal. Anyway, it wasn't until I was sober about 10 or 11 years at one of the first Cornhusker Roundups that I heard put into words by Clancy, one of my heroes, what really was wrong with me. Because I knew by that time, when I was 10 or 11 years sober, that alcohol, when I quit drinking, before I got to Alcoholics Anonymous, when I would stop drinking, things didn't get better, they got worse. Things got gray. Things were ugly. Life was ugly. The world was ugly. People around me were ugly. And when I drank, they turned beautiful. They got colorful. They were fun. They were happy. They had zest. And when I wasn't drinking, in between, it was dull, and it was ugly, and it was boring, and it was sad. It was sad. And I didn't see any benefit in being sober. I was a kid who had a wonderful, my parents were and are loving people. There was not a thing that I really lacked for in my life. It was a great life. We traveled, we lived all over the world. I got to go to school in France and in Switzerland, and I was educated in some of the finest places in the world. I came back, went to the University of California in Riverside. I had the trappings of a great life, but I was in it. And when being in it, I can take a wonderful, exciting life like that and make it a bad thing. I could make traveling a bad thing. You know, I could say, oh, I have to change this, and I have to get new friends, and I can't, you know, just complain. I don't like moving all the time. I have to make new friends. I don't, you know, all of that sort of thing. But, and I could do that with my life. But when I sobered up and I looked back on that through the benefit of the steps and a fourth and fifth and eighth and ninth, I could look at my life and say, my God, what a great deal. You know, you lived in France. You lived right in the middle of Paris. You lived in Switzerland. You got to go, you know, skiing, and you got to meet these people, these exciting people, and you lived in exciting times. But to me, it was I was drinking and I ended up there. It wasn't like I went there and took a drink. I was drinking and kind of flew there, you know. I was just there. And I had no real appreciation for everything, because everything was crowded out of my life. Everything but alcohol was crowded out of my life. Do you remember how that felt? I mean, do you remember the obsession with Al-Anon, the obsession of the person with us, the obsession of having to drink? My life was small. I lived in this huge world where all these things were happening, where exciting people were. It was all those years were exciting times. And I lived in this small glass bottle. And I was in that bottle on a daily basis. We were talking about this morning. I would get up and I would have to get something to drink. That was my first concern. I would get up and I'd have to find something to drink. I would have to make sure that I had like a beer can opener in my purse. And then I would have to go and get it. And I would have to get the money to get it. Then I would have to get the car to get to the place or walk to the place to get it. Then I would get it and I would put it in my purse. And I would go in the car to some deserted parking lot. And I would crouch down in the seat and I would open a beer and I would drink a beer. And then I would put it down on the floor. And when it was empty, and I'd open another beer and I'd drink another beer, and then I began to feel a little bit better, just a little bit better. And I would do that every single day, and then I would eventually have to find some place to pee, because if you drink beer like I drank beer, you got to find a place to pee. And you didn't want to sit in the wet side of the car, so you'd have to get out and find some place to pee. and then you'd have to get back in the car, and then you'd have to go find more to drink, and then you'd have to throw the empties away. Such a tedious, boring, dull, crappy life. I mean, it was just dull. And here I was in these surroundings with the Eiffel Tower over my shoulder, you know, or the lake in Geneva, Switzerland, the Lac Clément, right there, you know, right at in the Alps. I mean, it was just an incredible existence, and yet in it, it was so small. And it wasn't that I didn't have any fun, because I always had fun. I mean, I had fun in those days, but it was so, they were so few and far between, you know. I mean, I would get involved with groups. In Paris, I got involved with this group of musicians, and they were all studying music at the conservatory there in Paris, and I was in the languages, and I met this guy from New Orleans named Noel, who was learning to be a conductor, and we would drink. That's what we did. We got together because we all drank, and we drank, and we broke into the orchestra hall one night, and there were like a dozen of us, and we were all just more or less insanely drunk, and we each took an instrument, and I played the piano, and these other people were playing other instruments, and he was conducting, and we, you know, we didn't record it. I wish we had of, but it must have sounded like a train wreck, you know, and we were doing some concerto, and it was just it was insanity, and we would laugh, you know, and we'd fall off the chairs, and we'd lose the music, and you know, that kind of thing. And years later, I was driving over to Sarpy County Jail to take a Monday night meeting, and I heard that piece of music. I have some classical CDs, and I was playing this classical CD, and I heard this piece of music, and I flew back to those days. I'm a very sensory person, and I think most alcoholics are. We like color, you know. I can see things. I don't remember stuff that I hear necessarily, but when I see something, I can remember it. And I heard this piece of music, and I could see in my mind this whole deal where we did this music thing with Noel. So we had fun. I had fun, and I had fun when I would get involved with political organizations. I was always a rebel, and I got involved with this political organization, and we marched in Paris. We got in this big group of us, and we were all drunk, and we just marched on anything, you know. And I was marching in this large group of people, and I was kind of at the front, because I always liked to be at the front of anything. And I looked up, I was being mashed up against the bars of this place, this fence that surrounded this place. I looked up, and the American flag was flying over it. I was marching on the American embassy in Paris off of the place. My father was a diplomat at that time, so it wasn't real smooth. So I called him and told him that I might, because the police hauled us all down to the pokey, and they eventually turned us loose because we were just mostly students who were drunk. And I told him that, you know, I might appear somewhere in some blotter or something. And he just, his question was, were there any photographers around? He didn't want anybody taking pictures of me marching on the American embassy. But that was fun. You know, there were lots of times that were fun. On the other hand, there were times that now I look back on them and they were fun. But they weren't fun at the time. You know, I had this boyfriend at the University of California. I was doing I had so many credits. You know, when you travel around and you're drunk, I am, you get lots of credits. They don't mean anything. They're not coherent, but they're credits. And I had all these credits, and I had to go into LA to get all these credits sorted out. And they said, okay, you can take this upper division course, and we want you to write, do a, like a thesis symposium type of thing on Marcel Proust, 3-volume A la recherche du temps perdu, which is, Marcel Proust was at least a laudanum addict and probably an alcoholic who spent a lot of years of his life in his bed behind velvet curtains suffering from migraines, mainly being hung over from laudanum and alcohol, I think. But he wrote this big deal about how you always try to recapture your past. and how you never really can. And he took 3 entire volumes to say you can't, eventually. But I had to write a paper explaining why this was interesting and why I should stick through 3 volumes of very thin onion skin paper to do this. And that was all I had to do, was to do this paper. And I had a friend who used to meet me in the parking lot, and he was, his name was, well, I called him Zorro. I don't know what his name was. I can't remember. But he wore a black hat, big black hat, black cape. And he was a poet, so he told me. He wrote poetry to me. And he was, he smoked a lot of dope, and he was real slow, you know, which was good, you know, because I needed somebody slow around me, so to sort of keep me down. And so we would sit under the eucalyptus trees there, and I would drink vodka out of my thermos, and he would smoke dope and recite poetry to me. And he looked like Father Sarducci in the other. And I liked him. And during this period of time, I was living in Redlands and driving back and forth. And my sister, this is really kind of getting towards the end of my drinking. My sister lived in this bedroom with me, and we were talking on the way to the meeting today about unmanageability. Do the first 3 steps of Alcoholics Anonymous require action? Well, in some, you know, our interpretation is, well, sometimes they require action. Sometimes some people don't think they require action, at least, you know, physical. Well, some people get down on their knees to say the 3rd step. Some people lay in bed and say the 3rd step. Some people write out the 1st step and all that stuff. And I think sometimes we get a little too clinical about all of this, you know. Because I always, the thing I remember about being on my life being unmanageable is that, you know, here's my sister, we're sleeping in these 2 little, neat little cherry wood beds with the neat little chenille spreads on them. Her bed was always made, she had like 22 stuffed animals on it. Every animal was in its place. It had to be in a certain place because otherwise her life was not good. It was disordered. And I used to go switch them around so that she'd be upset, you know, because I liked seeing her upset. And she bleached her hair, and she rolled her hair up in these curlers that were really tight, and they pulled her skin back like that. She always looked like that when she looked at me anywhere. She was always like this. And I had started having a little bit unmanageable stuff in my life. Like, I had gotten up one night and gone over and opened the sliding door of my closet and squatted down and peed in my shoes in the middle of the night. And but I thought that could be explained satisfactorily by the fact that it was a door, and I had been confused in the night and just gotten the wrong little door. That's all. Well, this time I had a purse that was like a fisherman's creel, rope, wood lid. And it had flowers on it, but I took them off because I wasn't a flowery type of person. And it had like the staples were still in the top of it, you know, where they anchored these things down. I can remember that thing to this day. And it sat on this little needlepoint chair. And I got up in the night, and the next morning when I got up and walked over to my chair, I opened the lid of my purse because it was looking funny. It was supposed to be about this tall, it's about this big, and it looked like it, you know, had a nervous breakdown or something in the night. And I opened it up, and I, oh my God! And my sister rose up at all these stuffed animals with this very, very pre-Al-Anon face on. I mean, it smelled something bad right here, you know. Just she goes, I believe you peed in your purse. And of course I have. I mean, I have. But I dried out the money and spent it anyway in Southern California. But that's unmanageable. You know, that is unmanageable. It doesn't take a genius to figure out that I can't go to school the next day and say to Father Sarducci or Zorro, guess what I did last night? I peed in my purse. He was my only friend. I mean, what? I wasn't going to tell him that. You know, I had to, that was a
That was my life. That was amazing. I couldn't tell people what I was doing. I couldn't tell people the things that would, you know, the things I was doing, the way that I lived my life. I couldn't tell them the look in my mom's eye. I couldn't tell them, you know, how I got caught by the cops one time on the way to school, and how I could only roll the window down about that because I had been drinking beer and I had all these empty beer cans underneath. And there's so many things we have to do that are like unmanageable. Like if you drink like I drink, and you have I drove like a brewery. You know, I had all my beer in my car, and I would drive and drink. And when you do that, and you put your empties underneath the seat in case somebody stops you and they can't see them. But you have to drive very cautiously and carefully. You've got to put the brake on rather softly, or else when you jam it on like that, man, they all come rolling out from under the seat. What a tedious way to live. I mean, a tedious, those tiny little things that will do that. And that is not even to say, that has nothing to do with all of the more disastrous things that are happening in my life, but just those little things. And those little things are in the mosaic. You know, I think people's lives, if we get a chance in Alcoholics Anonymous when we come in and get sober, to look at our lives in mosaic style. And that is that, you know, a mosaic is all those little colored rocks. And all those little rocks have a purpose and a design. And everything that happens to us, I think, is one of those little colored rocks. And it all makes up this enormous pattern, which is, I am powerless over alcohol, and my life has become unmanageable. I had to come to believe, I had to make a decision. You know, all of those things can be viewed in that mosaic against the wall. But we can't see it at the time. I couldn't see it at the time. I truly lived hour to hour, day to day. I truly did. Now, I thought about yesterday, and I was guilty about yesterday, and I was fearful of tomorrow, and I was fearful of this afternoon. But I literally lived in the minute. Because from one minute to the next, where was I going to get the alcohol? I remember walking into a supermarket in East St. Louis, Illinois. Now, anybody around here who's been through East St. Louis, Illinois, knows that in those days, years ago, it was not a good place to be. This was the middle of the day, and I walked into a Safeway. I had enough money to buy a quart of beer or something to eat. And I was on that edge. You know the edge where you know you got to have something to eat or you got to have something to drink, and you don't know if you don't eat, are you going to be able to take the drink, or is it going to come right back up again? Or are you going to be able to get through? Or are you going to be able to drive home without that little bit of something or something? What are you going to do? And I walked into that Safeway, and I walked up and down the aisles quite a while, and I took a can of Vienna sausages or devil ham, I'm not sure which. I think it was Vienna sausages, and stuck it in my pocket because it's about this big around. Stuck it in my pocket, and I started to walk out the door. And I got so overwhelmed with fear that I took it out and put it down and ran out of and the manager came out after me, just standing in the parking lot like this. He knew. And God, I was so scared. I was so scared. And I couldn't go straight across the parking lot to the bar where to this package store was going to buy the quart of beer. I had to drive around and around and around and then go and get the quart of beer. That was what my life was like. Dumb, dumb stuff like that. And towards the end of my drinking, you know, my family has always been, they were so supportive. They wanted to help me so bad. And towards the end, you know, they didn't know what to do. And my sister said, come on, you look like you've been rode hard and put up wet. That's how I feel right now. It's really hot in here. You've been rode hard and put up wet, so let's fix your hair. Because my hair had died like 3 years before or something, and you know it does. It does. You drink enough alcohol, a quart of vodka a day, you'll do it. Your hair gets like, it stays in your head, but it's like really freaked out. I mean, it just sticks out all over like this, and it's like, like that. And like you stuck your finger in a light socket. So she said, let's do your hair. So she sat me down on the floor and put this cape over me and put this thing on me with holes in it and pulled these pieces of hair through these holes and put stuff on it. And she kind of got scared or something because she goes, oh, no. And I said, what's the matter? She said, something's wrong. No, oh, no, because she's frosting my hair. It's supposed to look distingue, you know, it's supposed to have all these nice little streaks in it. Anyway, she put some more stuff on it, and the long and the short of it was, when you drink the way that I drink, you have as much alcohol in your system as I do, you got a chemical head. You got hair that is literally virtually drunk. It is drunk hair. You put something on drunk hair, you got a bad reaction, you know? So she had a bad reaction, and I had orange hair. I had, like, orange hair, these big blobs of orange hair all over, and... Well, it was a sight to behold. Anyway, then they all fell out. I mean, all of those things fell out because they were dead anyway, and I came into Alcoholics Anonymous just a few weeks later with these big bald patches all over my head, wearing my drinking uniform, which was a blue turtleneck sweater and stretch pants size 14, and something orange had been spilled down the front of this sweater. And I have that sweater in my personal archives now. I've got it on the shelf in my closet. And that's how I arrived at the doors of Alcoholics Anonymous with this. And I walked around AA for months scratching my head because it itched, you know, where those little things had all fallen out, those patches there, they itched. And it was just, it was hideous. It was hideous. And I looked hideous and I felt hideous. But I was given, at that time, or shortly thereafter, the greatest gift I have ever been given. And it's something I wish for everybody. I really want to talk about this. We're given this enormous gift. And Clancy talks about it. Johnny talked about it. You know, we get ourselves to that place. But we're given this chance. And for a lot of us, it may be the only one we ever get. And that gift that I was given sometime in early February of 1964 was the gift of desperation. I was desperate enough to do things that I would have never 2 days, 3 days, a week before been willing to do. I was willing to do them. And it literally saved my life. I didn't know that at the time. I didn't know it, but I was out of ideas. And if you had to describe what you felt like when you surrendered, the way that I felt was so tired, I couldn't go on. I didn't have a single better idea. I gave it up. I gave it up. But that was a gift. That I didn't myself surrender. What happened to me was that I was surrendered. I was surrendered by the circumstances, by the alcohol, by the deal in my life, by where I was. And, you know, I was surrendered by a power greater than me. So that's a gift. And it has been, I know now, and Benoit and I were talking about this yesterday, it has been my responsibility to nurture, foster, and give away that gift. I can't keep it unless I give it, but I also have to give it to keep it. And I have to do something to earn it. It's a gift, yes, but, I mean, when people come in, sometimes they act like it's their right to be sober. It's not our right to be sober. It's a privilege to be sober. It's a privilege to be a member of Alcoholics Anonymous. If I don't know how to say it any other way. It's just not something that I can't take for granted for long. It's something I better appreciate, and I better pay back, and I better earn. Because once I have the information, then I got to take it from here. Once I get up on the horse, I better ride that sucker. You know, if I, and there are certain techniques that you can use to stay on a horse. One of them is focus. One of it is getting taught how to ride a horse. Another one is getting on the damn horse and staying on it for a while and riding. Another one is to have the proper gear. You know, a lot of those different things are necessary for me to ride that sucker. But I got to get on the horse and I got to stay on the horse. I've got a sponsor who tells me what kind of equipment to get, tells me what's expected of me. I was so glad those people told me what was expected of me because I didn't have any ideas. So I get up on the horse and I stay on the horse, and I've been riding this horse ever since. And I'll tell you, there are times when I would really like to get out off that horse. I get one foot in the stirrup and I'm swinging that leg over the back of the saddle. I want off this horse. And then somebody will call. Or I got to call Jean, my sponsor. Or I have to go to the jail. Or I got to do this. Or, you know, there. So I get to do these things. I get to ride that horse. And I'll tell you something. It can be a nag sometimes. Sometimes that's the ugliest horse you ever saw. Sometimes it's a stallion. Sometimes the sun is shining on my head when I'm galloping over those plains. Sometimes it's raining and it's cold and it's dark and it's icy. But if I ride that horse right, I'm part of him. Anybody who's ever ridden horses knows if you ride a horse right, it's part of you. You're part of you. And AA is a part of me. This is my horse. And I want to stay on it. But I don't want to be alone. I want you guys. I need a posse. I need a posse coming by. I need, you know, even if I'm not a sheriff, maybe I could just be part of the posse. You know, we can have Clancy as the sheriff. He'd be the sheriff. You're the sheriff this weekend. We'll get him a star. But I want to be part of the posse. And I want to enjoy that ride. And I've been enjoying that ride. Even when it's dark and rainy and cold. I'm just glad to be on the horse. But I want you guys with me. And so I got sober. I got the gift. I've tried to maintain the gift. I've tried to keep it polished. I've tried to muck out its stall. I've tried to shine it up and clean its hooves and wax the saddle, keep the reins good. I've tried to do that, and I have, for the most part, succeeded. So rain or shine, I'm on the horse. And I, you know, please, get your own horse and come along with us. We need people in the posse. So I got sober and I started the journey of Alcoholics Anonymous. And I have learned so much here. I've learned how to live here. I've learned how to succeed here. And I'd like to talk for just a few minutes, and then I'll shut down because we got Vinoy too. I want to hear the story of we had a little deal yesterday that I chose to think of last night as I was falling asleep, called the Battling Limousines. You remember the Battling Banjos? Remember that? Well, this is the Battling Limousines that we had yesterday. I'm going to let Vinoy talk to you about that, but we want to have plenty of time for her. But I want to talk about a couple of things. first of all, the actions of the steps of Alcoholics Anonymous, in my view, are designed to keep me small enough to be in the room. They are designed for me to get cleaned up on the inside to begin with, and then when I get myself all dirtied up, as I will, I mean, I have lost my temper at meetings. I have shaken my finger at people's faces. I have muttered stuff like bullshit during someone's share, if you will. I have raised my eyes to the ceiling on occasion. I wonder, I sponsor so many people who have this problem with judgmentalism. I wonder why that is. I have made judgments. I have done everything a human being could do wrong, except I've stayed in the room. I've stayed on my horse, and I've continued to ride, and I've continued to go to meetings. No genius there. I just show up, no matter what kind of a fool I made of myself the day before, or what fight I got into, or what mutinous thoughts are going on in my head. I've stayed in the room, and as long as I stay in the room, you know, somebody's going to give me a little piece to go on that'll get me through the day. So I go to four committed meetings a week, and if I miss them, it's because I'm deathly sick or I am out of town, and you can count on that. And there are people here in my home group, I think they come over to keep me honest for one thing, and secondly, but you can ask them. And they'll tell you that when I say I'm going to do something, I will do it. And that's not something that I'm like. I'm not like that. I want to take the easier, softer way. But because of Alcoholics Anonymous and you and the meetings and my sponsor, I am responsible for that, and I will show up. I am a person of integrity. I do keep my word. I am where I say I'm going to be when I say I'm going to be there. Sometimes I'm about 3 to 5 minutes late, but I am there. And that is important to me because I want to be a person of my word. It doesn't matter what your word is to me, but what matters is that I keep my word, and I am responsible for that. So I am a product of these things. I am still an egomaniac. I am still selfish and self-centered. I am. It is the root of my problem. It always will be. I suffer from alcoholism. This isn't going away. Just because I apply money or success or other things to it doesn't make alcoholism disappear. Nothing outside makes alcoholism disappear. This is in us, folks. And for Al-Anons, it's in them. Look at them. They don't even drink. I mean, they can't even drink, and they're sick. You know, I mean, they are. But they tolerate us. They put up with us, honey, when nobody else would. And my hat's off to them. If it hadn't have been for my mom and dad, Al-Anon to the, well, my mother especially, Max, I'd be dead. I'd have never made it to Alcoholics Anonymous. Because she's the one who came up to that attic apartment of mine that day when I was drinking and slapped me in the face and said, "You're going to that meeting." And I go, "I don't want to." Bam! "I don't care." She'd had an Al-Anon slip, and I was really glad for it. She ended up taking me out to the country, folding me in half in the back of a Porsche and taking me to the country and dumping me on the front porch of a drying out place because I was too drunk to go to the meeting. But she dumped me out there. 6 inches of snow on the ground and me folded up on the porch, you know, and kind of rang the bell and signed a check and ran is what she did, my mom did. But I'll tell you, we suffer from this thing now. Now. I mean, talk to Clancy or Johnny or Nancy, or thanks for coming too. I know you came for Clancy, but never mind. Or Jack, you know, or Leslie. Talk to Leslie, she'll tell you. We're not like other people. We're not. Much as we would like to think we are. You can go join your country clubs You can go golfing in the best places in the world, and down inside, like Johnny said last night, we're still not a part of them. We're in it. We're not of it. And we need a safe, well-lighted place to come. And Alcoholics Anonymous is a safe, well-lighted place. No matter what we do, we're not going to shoot you here. We're not going to shoot you. We may judge you, but we ain't going to shoot you. Because if we shot you, somebody'd shoot us. So we'd all be dead. There'd be no meeting, and that's no good. This is a great place to be. This is Alcoholics Anonymous. This is the best place for an alcoholic, Al-Anon, Al-Ateen, Al-Dog, Al-Fish, whatever. I mean, you know, we affect a lot of people around us. But because I never, ever, I mean, I'm sober 37 years. You think I'm normal? No, I'm not. You know I'm not normal. I never will be. Big secret, to me, anyway. I don't want to be. I don't want to be normal. You know, normal is like well-balanced. 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 Balanced. Boring. And I will do something to cause an imbalance, either in my life or somebody else's life, just for fun. And I think it's fun. And I think it's exciting. And I don't want to be other ways. I don't want to have total emotional maturity. How could I be a football fan and be emotionally balanced? I can't. You gotta live and die. You gotta bleed with them. You gotta get their injuries. You gotta suffer through every play. Of course. No, I'm not even gonna say it. But I love football. I love football. I love football. I love football. I love snot running out of people's noses during football games. I like blood running down their arms. I like mud in their helmets. I like big, beefy guys. Big, big old beefy guys mashing each other at the line. You know, it's like vicarious living for me to go to a football game. I'm not well. I like art. I mean, I like doing art. You know, just splashing water on this page and throwing color on it and see what happens. And that doesn't go with football. You know, it's just like football. Art. Football. Art. I'm a classical piano player. Football. I'm a dichotomy. I don't want to be any other way. Because if I were any other way, I couldn't enjoy football and art. I couldn't. Not me. So what I have to do is stay with you. Because you and the program of Alcoholics Anonymous allow me to go out there for 20 hours a day or 15 hours a day, and they never know. They never know what's lurking in their midst. I act like they look, but I'm not. So I have to come here so you can tell me you're just acting like you're really like us. And I can be happy here. And I can take the happiness, that enthusiasm, that God within, from here and go out there. Last deal. Please be sponsors. Please be sponsors. Please grab some unsuspecting victim. I don't care who it is. I'll even sponsor little Mia. grab some unsuspecting victim and grab them out and say, I will sponsor you. They're new. They don't know you can't do that. Just get them. And before long, they'll think they have to anyway. So then you've got somebody to sponsor. And there's, I'll tell you, being sponsored is great. But sponsoring is like strawberries and cream on top of the cake. It is the best. It is the best. Because then I got to take it and pass it along. I got somebody to ride with. I got a side saddle with a big book in it. You know, I got people to go on my over the plains with. You know, I got my Tonto. I got a Tonto if I'm the Lone Rangers. I got Tonto. Deputy Sheriff. My sponsor is so important. But being able to pass it along. And I'm a great person for images, and here's an image, and I thought about this the other day. It's like this. I'm a pool. I'm like a mountain pool. And there's this water that's coming from the mother pool, the bigger pool, that's a little bit higher up the mountain, more spiritually fit than me. Is this mother pool is up here. It's this fresh water right out of the snow's pool. And water comes through that pool and trickles down into my pool. So here I am in a pool. Now I got all these little rivulets out here, in my case 50 or so, of people that I sponsor. So there's little bits of pool running out in these little rivulets. We got the mother pool coming through there into my pool and out into your pool. Now, if these people down here in my littler pools don't pass what they have on, the water starts getting stagnant. And if I can't sponsor them, if I'm not privileged enough to be able to do that, then that water in their pool starts backing up into my pool. And I get stagnant. Plus, I get all that crap that they build up in those pools because they're not passing it on. It gets backed up into my pool, and I have to listen to them whine about their petty little problems. Whereas if you get them out there and they get to start sponsoring people, you don't hear much about their problems. They'll call and say, do you know what she did? Let me tell you what she did. She went down the street and she had, what is that stuff? Knowledge, carnal knowledge, that's cleaning it up, with three different guys down the street. And then I'll go, let me see, 3 years ago it was, you came to me and said that Mr. So-and-so and Mr. So-and-so and Mr. So-and-so were all going to get together at this thing and you had, you know, with all three of these. Isn't that interesting? What did I tell you to do? And then she passes it on to other people. Cling to the thought that in God's hands, our path, which sometimes is the only thing we have, is going to benefit others if we just pass it on. So, get on your horse. Well, let's see. Saddle it up. Get on the horse. And let's ride on out. Thanks. Yeah.